Well, now, five topics are going to be covered which interrelate but are not sequential. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but it could be anything else. They're teasing out all the different facets is one of the great problems. First one is thinking Christianly about people. Our thinking has been very heavily affected by Darwin, Marx and Freud. 19th century still reigns very supreme in 20th century thinking. And as Christians in our particular context, we've also been very heavily affected by parochialism. That is, the village mentality, as Peter was speaking about yesterday, Peter Calder was speaking about yesterday, the sense that if I'm the minister in the parish, then I am, in a sense, responsible for every soul who lives within a certain geographical area, and that there is a kind of village there that people actually live in. Even though I might be in the heart of Redfern, I still have that village mentality. And then, of course, our thinking is affected by our own particular family culture and background, our immediate family, mum, dad, and so on. Now, because of this kind of background to our thinking, I tend to think that Christians have a need-dependent, centred guilt complex. Guilt, because we're middle class, educated and literate people. It was an enormous relief to me to find out that I don't have to be guilty about being middle class. And if you're going to reach the Australians, 90% of them call themselves middle class, so why not be middle class? I don't know who the other people are. And it's actually Christianity which creates many middle class values. It's Christianity which creates much education. Part of the reason that Christians are more educated is not because we reach educated people, but because we tend to create education amongst people. That's the chicken and the egg problem there. You've got to weigh up. We actually teach people to be prudent about the use of money, so in the end they become wealthy. We teach them better style of living, so they tend to become healthy. We teach them the concern for their children, so they become better educated. We are the creators of the middle class, so don't get guilty about being middle class. It's the way we are. In fact, there's tremendous advantages about being middle class, but we have a knee-jerk reaction so that if someone comes from something other than the middle class, we feel that we really must help them because, after all, they aren't us and we need to reach them, and we ignore the middle class that's all around us. We have a need-dependent centeredness in our idea about people, in our thinking about people. It's partly got to do with the fact that we want to be needed ourselves, and so we create programs which are all need-centered because that makes us essential, and it also makes people dependent upon us. We want to have churches where people need us. We want to find the places in the community where people need us so that we are needed. Because we get the distinct impression no one wants us, which of course is absolutely true. And we have some good elements to this terrible misperception. There are some good elements to it which actually then give it power. That is, compassion for the weak, for the fatherless, for the widows. They're good and godly things, you see. And so we get that mixed up with this sense of wanting to be needed and the sense of guilt about being middle class and educated and thinking. It's a crime to think now. Unless you are someone who doesn't think, who just has images, you're somehow less than a true human being. It's a crime to have a good attitude towards fathers. Have you noticed that, by the way? You're not allowed to think fathers are nice things anymore. There's something distorted in your mind. Now, when you come to talk about needs, Marx, Freud, Darwin is what defines needs. We tend to think in terms of the alienated, the psychiatric, the impoverished, the economically marginalised, the socially marginalised. They're the people with needs. I don't believe they're the people with needs at all. I believe sinners are people with needs. I think we've got to think Christianly. And then, of course, our whole strategies become this need-dependent, centred guilt complex. He who crosses the greatest gulf is the one who's doing the greatest job. And so we try and cross enormous cultural gulfs that we are totally incapable of doing, really. And we keep spending resources on lost causes. Right? If it's a lost cause, then it's godly. If it's a possible win victory, well, then anybody could do it. It's not worth doing. We keep creating strategies that will create dependencies and therefore, in the long run, create needs. If you want to get a congregation to have massive psychological problems, appoint a psychologist on your staff. That's one of the easiest ways. They create problems. Counselors create the need for counseling. That's what they do. Yeah, I use counselors, not just personally, but for amongst other people. But there's a huge gulf between me and the counselor in terms of staff work, because Christian ministry is not counseling. That's a different thing. It's a different animal. And if your church is built on counseling, your church will be filled with problem people who are not getting better, but who are keeping on finding new problems, because that's the only way to be in the club. It's a terrible disaster as a way of doing it. And we disfigure the gospel. Because instead of the gospel ministry being about sin and salvation and eschatology and so on, the gospel ministry is about navel-gazing, psychological problems, economic difficulties, all about this world rather than the world to come. It in the end ceases to be cross-centered, even when it's a good godly Christian form of counselling. It will cease to be cross-centered often. And of course, we get this irrational glamorisation. It's like you can see it in the empire builders of the previous century who believed in the British Empire and so on. We can laugh at them, but we've still got the same problem, that missionary societies can raise money for work amongst cannibals more quickly and easily than they can raise money for work amongst city dwellers, middle-class city dwellers. It costs very little money to minister amongst cannibals, and there are very few left to minister amongst, but you can get lots of money for them. It costs an enormous amount of money to reach middle-class city dwellers of South America, but it's very hard to get anybody to give money for them. Because, you see, we perceive people are only worth reaching if they've got problems. And middle-class urban dwellers don't have problems. They're just going to hell. We still will invest our missionary dollar in the village situation, the jungle situation, rather than the urban situation and the city. Even though the whole world's population is heading towards the cities, even though culture moves from cities to villages rather than villages to cities, we keep putting money down where the whole thing is heading away from. Because it's part of our need-centred mentality, which is not really, I think, Christian thinking about people. We still think that a missionary is someone who goes overseas. And so, if our friends care to go to Italy to preach the gospel, we'll call them missionaries and give them all the honour that is due a missionary. But if they care to preach to the Italians in Sydney, well, of course, they're just parish workers. Christian thinking about people seems to me to start off with creation and salvation, of course. That God has created us and we are all creatures dependent upon him, and that we have all fallen in sin. I'm only rehearsing the catechism at this point for us, aren't I? And that God's work of redemption was for mankind, that we are the objects of God's love, and that the gospel is for all mankind, because there is only one God, and because there is one mediator between man and God, the Lord Jesus Christ, who paid the ransom price, and because we are all sinners. And so the gospel is for all people. Now the division between mankind is not the division of Jew and Gentile, but the division of those who are in Christ and those who are out of Christ, those who are in sin and those who are of the new creation. I must view people not the way the world views people. I must view people by the way of the gospel. I was preaching last night in church on our Wednesday night congregation on 1 Corinthians 16. It's a fascinating passage to try and preach on. You must give it a burl sometime. It's a real test of a great preacher. I failed. Verse 22 has a marvellous verse, hasn't it? If anyone doesn't love the Lord, a curse be on him. Now, hands up those who have got that as this week's memory verse. It's not your favourite, but I've never seen anyone do a little tapestry and hang it on the wall. On if anyone doesn't love the Lord, a curse be on him. But that is a Christian way of thinking. That is the Christian way of thinking. Because we view the world from the point of Christ, from the point of view of the new creation. I suspect, and I suggest to you, friends, that we don't view the world from that perspective at all. That Marx and Freud, Darwin even, have more impact on the way we view people than the Lord Jesus Christ.
And that affects our choices in church planting and church growth and church ministry and evangelism. That we will not see people as being in and out of Christ. In fact, we are constantly being told not to talk about people like being born-again Christians. To be able to talk about a person that's not a Christian is a most offensive thing to say in the Australian culture. I've even found people objecting to me saying that some of my Jewish neighbours are not Christians. I've had people violently oppose me for saying such a derogatory thing about Jews. Because of this Christian view, there is no one, this is a double negative, sorry, there was no one that I will not talk to. I'll do the double negative. That is, I will talk to everyone or anyone about the gospel. No one is to be excluded from the gospel claims. But because of this view, no one has greater demand upon me to speak to them than anybody else either. The gospel is not the gospel for the poor as if it's not the gospel for the rich. It's not the gospel for the lame as if it's not the gospel for the healthy. It's not the gospel for the sick as if it's not the gospel for the healthy. The gospel is for all people. There's no one that I won't talk to, and everyone has equal demand. But then you say, well, what of the poor? What of the prisoners? What of the oppressed? What of Luke 4? I hope you've got that clear and that your college is helping you get that clear by teaching you to read the Bible better than most people read Luke 4. When did Jesus ever go to prison? When is he ever recorded going to prison and releasing one prisoner? Not. And look at the poor that he evangelized. Zacchaeus. Levi. Why, even Peter and John were partners in the fishing industry. They weren't just the workers. They had workers under them. Joseph of Arimathea. The rich young ruler. Jesus speaks to the rich as well as to the poor. The women who travel around with him, who provided for his needs. They weren't poor. No, Matthew isn't right when he talks in terms of being poor in spirit, longing for the kingdom, mourning for the coming of the kingdom. The poverty is the spiritual poverty. The prison is the spiritual oppression that we are under Satan. And Jesus, remember, turned his back on the needy. Don't ever forget that Jesus turned his back on the needy. He did in Mark chapter 1. Having done all the healing miracles, they come out and say, everybody's gathered there. And he says, I must go on elsewhere to preach the gospel. Which he went on to other needy people. But he doesn't only respond to the needs that are in front of him. Indeed, when he sends out the 12 in Matthew chapter 10, he tells them not to go to the Samaritans. Not to go to the Gentiles. They were needy. They were more needy than the people of Israel. But only go to the house of Israel. And the Canaanite woman who comes to him in Matthew 15, she really has to bend his arm to get him to take action. Because she's not on his program. You cannot help everybody at once. And we must remove from ourselves the great British white man's burden of feeling the responsibility of helping everybody at once. Television and the media generally have made this intolerable for us. As I am made to feel guilty about every Aborigine who has ever died in Tasmania before I was born. That I was made to feel guilty for Ethiopia, the Sudan, for Chile, for China, for everywhere. I personally am responsible, which is just not true. Paul had to make decisions as to where he was going in his ministry. 1 Corinthians 16 is another classic illustration of it just last night as I was looking at it again. As to whether he was going to stay in Ephesus and then go on to Macedonia and then go on to Corinth, but he's not sure whether then he'll go on to Jerusalem, but he can't be everywhere. He's got to make choices, just like you and I have to make choices. And there's a lovely verse at the end of Galatians 6, where he's speaking, not the end of Galatians 6, but in Galatians 6, where he's saying, inasmuch as you have opportunity, do good to everyone, especially the household of faith. Three-point sermon is very important for you there, isn't it? As you have opportunity. You're not responsible for everything. You're responsible for the opportunities that are there before you, which in some of us are very limited. Some of us are overwhelming. As you have opportunity. Do good to all men. There's no differentiation at that point, is there? Everybody has some claim upon us because it's the gospel for all men in the end. But there is a priority system, especially the household of faith. Especially that group we have responsibility for.
False is the worldly view that the rich are more important than the poor. James chapter 1 will do as an illustration of as much as anywhere else. That is a false view. False also is the inverted worldly view that the poor are more important than anyone else. That is just as worldly. It's the inverted snobbery that we've got to overcome. We are after sinners for salvation, and they're everywhere. So we then have to make choices as to which sinners I'm going to speak to next. It happens to be you. Second topic. There's the first topic. Christian thinking about people. In case you forgot the topic, or I gave an exact wording to it, which is better than that, wasn't it? Thinking Christianly about people. Second topic. From resource to market. From resource to market. The gospel has a movement. The gospel movement is from God to man, from Jerusalem to the ends of the earth, from the cross to the parousia, from those who have the gospel to those who have not got the gospel. That's one of those kinds of pieces of teaching where the faithful all nod and tick and write their notes and say, yes, okay, that's right, but miss the point. So let me give it to the alternative. The gospel movement is not from searching and seeking to discovery. The gospel movement is not from need and longing and wanting to satisfaction. The gospel is not from people's hunger and dissatisfaction to provision. That is, the first view, the one that I say is right, the first view finds a gospeler and sends him out. The second view looks for people's needs and tries to satisfy them. It uses that famous line, you must scratch where people itch. Rubbish! You must teach people where they should be itching. Don't scratch them where they itch, because where they're itching, and this is the point nearly always, you've got to teach them where to be itchy. See, the first view sets the agenda and gives the answers. The second view accepts the world's agenda, tries to give the answers, and distorts the gospel. There's a great catchy book title that came out some years ago, which people keep on taking up now. You know, if Christ is the answer, what's the question? And the attack upon we Christians is that we keep on giving this answer, Christ, but no one's asking the questions. And so what we've got to do is find out what people's questions are so that we can answer their questions. I disagree with that completely. Christ is the question and the answer. He's both. Christ is the question that the world has to be asked, as well as the answer that the world has to be given. The gospel doesn't come from men. It comes from God, through Christians to men. The movement is very important in our thinking. Peter Kelder used a good illustration of it yesterday, one that I resonated with immediately. The youth group where you run the activity like mad and go up for... He had a marvellous youth group, 50% of fun, 50% of study. We used to run it 3 hours of fun and 5 minutes of study. And we couldn't get beyond the 5 minutes with the pagans we grew up in. And of course, after about 5 years of solid evangelistic work, Friday night by Friday night, we found no one had been converted. When we scrapped the whole program and just ran Bible study, the numbers dropped dramatically. But after a year or two, quite a lot of people got converted. Because what we were doing was answering the world's questions their way, making fun for the people, etc. But we were decrying the Bible. We were declaring the Bible was worth 5 minutes at the end of a good night. That was what our message was worth. Once we said, no, our program is teaching the Bible, then sure, we didn't reach as many people, but when they came, they were genuinely reached because the question and the answer was put to them. It was over and over. You see it when you call them to evangelise. Every now and then people want me to evangelise because they want me to try and get big crowds in. They want me to speak on a vital topic of today. And if they ask me to speak on Christ, I've got a chance of getting the message across. When they ask me to speak on Christ and abortion, well, in all honesty and integrity, I mean, if people have come because of the title, I've got to tell them about abortion, haven't I? So 50% of my time is now lost just talking about abortion. And then I've got to try and explain Christ, and then I've got to explain Christ in such a way as people will see the significance of that for abortion. So not only is 50% lost on that, but 50% of my exposition of Christ is lost, trying to show the relevance of Christ to abortion. So I've actually only got 25% of the chance now of communicating Christ. And anyway, the reason they've come is they've been all motivated about the issue of abortion. So when I give the Christ section, that's the bit they fall asleep for. It really does not help to speak on those kinds of topics evangelistically. It's good pre-evangelism. It gets them along, gets them used to listening to the preacher. Makes them feel nice. They think, oh, he's a good speaker. I'll come back and listen to him some other time. The other time when they speak on Christ, you've got a chance of evangelizing them. That's the problem over and over again. We accept the false diagnosis of the world and we then try to give the correct medication. If you've got the wrong diagnosis, you've got Buckley's at getting the right medication in. Ministry, then, is not customer-driven. Ministry is salesman-driven. Change my imagery. That is, the essence of ministry is not the shop, the surgery. The essence of ministry is the advertising, is the agent, is the door-to-door salesman who has a product and who's going to teach the community the need for the product and then provide for them the product. That's the image of Christian ministry, rather than we open up a shop and then people will come in because they want what we've got and know that they want it. And therefore, to be in evangelistic ministry, as if there's any other kind, that's our ex-mossop, isn't it? To be in evangelistic ministry requires you to have initiative and conviction, and it requires you to try and recruit personnel and to accumulate resources and utilize resources and train people and encourage people and develop markets. That's what Christian ministry is about. It's not about opening up a building and hanging out your sign. That's not what it is about. And so, of course, to see church planting as an exercise in building church buildings is complete and utter absurdity. Totally back to front. Don't build the buildings. Recruit the workers. The great power for growth in the Diocese of Sydney is Moore College. If you ever lose sight of that, we're done. Because the way you grow churches is through ministers of the gospel. And so the investment in the recruiting and training of the ministers of the gospel is the investment in the growth of churches. But putting buildings up is a sheer waste of money. So, while I am to preach in season and out of season, which doesn't mean when people want to hear me and when people don't want to hear me, but when it's convenient to me and when it's inconvenient to me, the in season and out of season is my season ability, not the people's. Do make sure you're clear on that one. While I've got to preach in and out of season, that is, I've got to preach anytime, anywhere, to anyone. Like Jesus, who tries to withdraw from the crowds, but they follow him, so he preaches anyway. Yet, I've got to keep paying attention to the resources, to the development, equipment, and recruitment of resources. So while Jesus is preaching to the crowds, and when people come, he answers anyway, yet he keeps on withdrawing away with the 12 to train, to equip, to teach, to help them see it in great depth. Likewise, Paul, I mean, he has this tremendous ministry, teaching and preaching, standing in the hall of Tyrannus, arguing day after day, but he also has Timothy and Titus, and he instructs Timothy to find faithful men to whom he can commit it to other faithful men. The two things run hand in hand in Christian ministry, that we've got to invest in the people. People in ministry is, in fact, the growth factor. People in ministry is the multiplier, if you go for that great geometric multiplication system by which we can conquer the world in 16 years. It's the multiplying factor. I, in my evangelism, are an addition factor. As I evangelize, one after one after one, here's the gospel. As I recruit a fellow evangelist, two after two after two, and another fellow evangelist, three after, it's the multiplying factor in it. A key to growth is God's chosen method. That is, ministers of the gospel.
God chooses to spare his gospel through people. That's a marvellous method. It's very simple to understand. That is, Christian ministry is much more like pyramid selling than shopfront selling. Now, I know pyramid selling is a very negative term in our community because it's immoral for a whole range of reasons, but it's much more the idea of recruiting other salesmen into the task than it is about opening up some building somewhere where you invite the community to come in. But our thinking is all about opening buildings and inviting communities in. We've been doing it for centuries. And although we in our romantic days of youth reading our Bibles see that in 1 Corinthians 16 again last night, the house in the church of Aquila and Priscilla, and we say, yes, yes, you can have churches in houses, we don't need buildings. We all race out and build buildings. We can't get our minds free of the idea that church doesn't have to be buildings and public services. Some years now I've been trying to teach and encourage our staff to see our goals and our patterns of ministry. And those of you who have served on our staff at church, blessings on you. This day, the others are labouring after many long days of study and hearing talk after talk, as Peter has suggested. But you are labouring after hearing the same talk that you have heard for the last 10 years. That is much harder for them, Peter. They all need special bonuses today. They can go and serve morning tea. Now, so you'll excuse me for a minute while I just run through something that you could run through, but we've worked for some years, there's a slight modification for it, old-timers. We've worked for some years on the EE principle. Not evangelism explosion, but the five E's. Here are our goals in ministry. My personal goals in ministry. One, evangelize. I just saw someone write down all five. One, evangelize. I'm glad you got the point. Two, edify. That we not only seek to bring the unconverted under the sound of the gospel and see them converted, but having seen them converted, we build them up in the faith of the Lord Jesus Christ and continue so we present them mature in Christ at the end. Three is actually 2B, is the new modification. Three and four are actually kind of 2A and B, I'll put it that way if you like. They're sub-points of edify. You've got to see them as that. We aim to equip people for the ministry of the gospel. That's number 3 or 2A. And number 4 or 2B is that we seek to export them into the mission field of the world. And number 5 or big 3 is we seek to enlarge. This is all summarised under the magnificent word empire. I refuse to be browbeaten by people who say, oh, you're only an empire builder. I say, praise God, wish there were more. I'm for it, through and through. Let's stop this weak-kneed kind of approach to what we're trying to do. I am out to conquer the world for Christ Jesus. That's what I'm, there's nothing shorter than that. Why should I aim for something shorter than that? He died for the world. Why should we go for anything less? Sydney is too small. The world is what we want to reach with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we're not going to do that without building a mighty empire, are we? The key thing is, who's the emperor? If that's not the Lord Jesus Christ, then you're in troubles. Now, evangelize, edify, but notice under edify, if you are going to build somebody up in Christ, in Christ-likeness of character, then you must build them up as one who ministers. Because you can't be like Jesus without becoming a servant, can you? And in what is Jesus' service but the salvation of mankind? You cannot be like Jesus without being utterly committed to the salvation of mankind. You cannot be like Jesus without being willing to lay down your life for the salvation of mankind. And I don't mean to make them feel better about their corns and their long leg or their short leg. I mean making them someone who is out of hell and into heaven. Let's put it in the terms that we can actually understand. That's what we're talking about, relating to God as their father rather than the devil as their captor. That's what I'm talking about.
And unless I'm concerned for doing that, I'm not like Christ, because that's what he died for. That's what he was born for, that's what he lived for, that's what he died for. Now, if someone's going to serve in that ministry, then I've got to help equip them in whatever aspect of the ministry, whatever gifts God has given them. But you see, the empire is not the Philip Jensen empire, it's the export empire. It's not that we will just grow more and more here so that if we will grow out there so that we can reach the world. And then every year, my aim is to make it just one notch bigger than last year. Everything. Evangelize more, edify more, equip more, and export more every year. Right? If every year can be just bigger, then we're growing. We're on the way up rather than the way down. Now, in this identifying of the market, over to the second heading, from resource to market. In this resource to market idea, you've got to look at what the markets are that are around you and what are the resources that you have. I start from looking at my resources to then looking at the market. The market is the whole of mankind. So I don't have to look at that. I've got that already worked out. Now, what resources are at my disposal? When I've worked out the resources at my disposal, I can start looking at mankind around about me and see what part of mankind I can reach today, or tomorrow, or next year, or the year after. I don't start off looking at mankind and saying, look, there's a tremendous need over there. Let me see how to reach there. Because then I could spend 5 years trying to develop resources so as to be reached over there, which if I just looked over here, there are all kinds of people here which would provide me the resources to reach over there next week. But I've spent 5 years trying to muster my own resources to make this huge leap to the other side of the world when it's quite unnecessary. I start off with a resource analysis. Where am I at now? Anyone's as good to reach as anybody else. So whoever I can reach is worth reaching. Whoever. Now, the parochial system is a good system at this point in one sense. Rather than making the choice is semi-made for you, you're dumped down in this country town. And this is why I'm a denominationalist, because it gives you resources, straight up. That's the beauty, that's the end point, good point of denominationalism, the problems we can all see. They provide me with a building, they provide me with a house, they provide me with a salary, they provided me with a structure of some kind, they provide me with the best theological college in the world, they provide me with all kinds of resources straight up that Christian brothers and sisters in previous centuries have provided for the very purpose I want to use them for. So I've got no guilt about taking other people's resources, I'm using the resources for which they've been given to reach the world. And so I've given those resources. But that immediately also provides for me a marketplace, doesn't it? If I'm dumped down in Castle Hill, okay, there's my marketplace, the surrounding residences of that area. There's nothing wrong with that, especially if you're living in a village. Because the parish system is created for the village life. A bit of Calder is completely right in that area. And there are still some villages in this world. Tinga. There are actually villages in the city. You'll find a few. Not many, but there are a few. I used to work down a little place called Hurstville Grove, and in those days the road didn't go straight through. The road used to stop, if you know that road. So that actually there was only one way into Hurstville Grove and one way out of Hurstville Grove, and there was one bus that went into Hurstville Grove and serviced the whole of Hurstville Grove. And it was a village. Everybody caught the same bus. Right? The key to evangelism there was bus evangelism. Because that was the thing that held everybody. One little school, there was one shop, there was one everything. Three churches. And so, there was a village in the middle of the city. Good. Yeah. Right, the parish, you see, gives me all these resources to kick off. And gives me, therefore, a pattern of ministry in village life, which in the end will create a church filled with women, children and elderly people. That is exactly what our parishes are, because we've used our resources to reach the people that those resources can reach. It's totally predictable that our churches will be like that. With, of course, the movement of women into the workforce, we now just have the children and the elderly. But, of course, if you're living in cities, then you've got to start looking at the resources you've got to reach people quite differently. And if you move out of perceiving yourself just as the parish minister responsible for the people who live in a certain geographical area around about you, then your whole approach to reaching people is going to be transformed. People in cities live in social groupings, in interest groupings, in sometimes family groupings, large extended families. I remember reading a study some years ago which showed that the people who visited people's homes most were relatives. That when you did a survey of, you know, the 10 people who visited the home in any particular suburban home, you know, 8 out of the 10 will be relatives. That people just don't actually visit homes of other people. We then try and set up home evangelism and invite people to come into people's homes and find it doesn't work. That's because we aim for neighbours instead of family. We've just got to understand how people live in cities. Now you might start to try and evangelise a work group, or you might try and understand people as, let me put it the other way. Why are people living where they are living, or where do they live in their minds rather than with just in terms of where do they live in terms of what's their address, where they pick their mail up and house and feed and scrub their bodies? Well, they live at work, or they live in their study program, or they really live in their recreation program. They endure work in order to really meet up with people in their volleyball club or their netball club or their stamp collecting, or they you can meet people through their problems or through their ethnic grouping or whatever it may be. But that's where they live. That's where they have their being. That's where they have their social organisation. That's where they have their reality. That's what life is about for them, is that kind of interconnection, which is citywide, not parish-bound. And if we're going to work and minister in a city like Sydney, and the more you are into the urban heart of the city, the more you've got to be like this, you have to minister citywide. Out Castle Hill, you might still be in a village. Long time since I've been to Castle Hill. In Paddington, there is no village. It's not there. That's nowhere. They're all city dwellers. High rise. As soon as you see people living in a high rise, they are not living in your parish. The building may be in your parish, but the people aren't. No one in a high rise lives in a suburb. That's actually not where they live. The building happens to be in the suburb. But the reason they're in the building has absolutely nothing to do with the suburb. It has to do with proximity to work, proximity to beaches, proximity to neighbours. It has to do with poverty that they're trying to get themselves out of the high rise, but has no commitment to the local area. How could you have a commitment to a local area and live on the 22nd floor? It's just not where they are. And so to say, oh, my parish is full of high rise, therefore I want to develop a strategy to reach high rise workers, first thing you're going to do is stop thinking about the parish. Most of our congregation live in high rise, flats of some kind. But they live in a 20-minute radius from our church. So having seen my resources, I can start looking at which of the markets. Take the country one, the Presbyterian one I asked earlier, you see. You say, what do I do when I arrive in this country town, the Presbyterian church? I say the resources of the Presbyterian church in a local country town are almost zilch. All they can do is give you a living, a house. That's about what they can do. The resource that I've got, and the only resource I get from a local Presbyterian, run-down, dead Presbyterian church in a little country town, the only resource that I've got, my own energy. That's the resource that's left. I, out of my energy, will now go find another group of people that I can relate to and start building something completely different, another structure. The resource that they give me is just the money to live, that's all. There's many churches like that around the city as well, I might add. So, once I've sought out my resources, I can start saying, okay, who is reachable with the resources at our disposal? I've had people who have tried to start, I'll change some of the words here, tried to start Spanish work, even though they've got no one in their congregation who speaks Spanish or any connection with the Spanish community. But they say, but the Spanish community live just down the road from us. They may live down the road from you, but they may as well live in Spain. You actually have no resources to reach them at this stage of the game. Now, if you want to do it, you can do it. You can go out and find someone who speaks Spanish and employ them to come and live here and to start reaching amongst them. But you'll most likely get a Basque instead of a Spaniard. That is, you need to identify the market by the congregation that is already there. A friend was approached about going to a church where 15% of the parish boundaries were people who were Muslims. That equaled 3,000 people. There were no ex-Muslims, no one with any Muslim connection within the congregation. He had no experience of anyone like that. He felt like turning it down. But I pointed out the same statistics showed that there were 21% who were Anglicans. That is, 4,200 people in the parish boundary had that connection of wanting to tick the box saying they're Anglican. There's still a large group of people to reach. 3% of the Anglicans would be about 120 people. But there are only 40 in the church, only 1%. Why was there only 1% in the congregation? Because it was an area of retired blue-collar workers, and we don't reach blue-collar workers anyway very well. And so, in fact, it was a bad church to go to, really, because it had no resources to reach even the Anglicans. Retired people. All that could be done with that set of resources was maintenance. That was all that was left to do with that particular context, in my view and judgment. Now, that's a worthwhile thing to do, go and maintain them. If you're actually thinking you're going to be able to, from that basis, build a great Anglican outreach to the Muslim world, you couldn't even build an outreach to the Anglican world in that context. You've got to look at the resources first as to where you're going. Now, within our work over the years, we have founded churches, Vietnamese churches, Italian workers, Greek church, Chinese church, an Indonesian church, Croatian church, Korean gathering that is there, several Catholic churches, and we've ministered and founded several Anglo-Saxon churches, all in the last 15 years within our work. But every time we started with somebody in the ethnic group who we'd come across somewhere. Never started from, oh, there's a group of Indonesians there, let's try and reach them. Last couple of years ago, we met a lovely Indonesian Christian who was studying on a university. So we encouraged him, cultivated his friendship, equipped him in ministry. Next thing we know, there's 15 Indonesians gathering around. We're reaching this Indonesian, we're now reaching out into that community. We start with the resource we have, rather than starting off looking for the need. Lovely man, very talented and gifted. When during the days of South Vietnam, there are a whole group of postgraduate students doing work in New South Wales University. A couple of them were converted. So we started a Bible study for these two PhD students. Brilliant men. I mean, they were Colombo plan students back in the days when you had to be a freak to be able to get out of a place like Vietnam on a Colombo plan. Brilliant, brilliant men. Saigon fell later that year. And then the boat people arrived. Here were two men who could organise the United Nations with their arms tied behind their backs, converted, keen for Christian ministry, and all these Vietnamese people came in. Within a matter of 6 months, they'd left us, and I was glad that we exported them because the refugees didn't live anywhere near us and they didn't have any means of transport. They were out Cabramatta and all kinds of other areas. But within just a few months, four or five different Vietnamese churches were founded by these couple of fellows. They did the work. They set the whole thing up and ran it. And we came across one boatman who was a pastor. He was making doors out in a factory in the western suburbs somewhere because and handing out tracts in the street trying to find Vietnamese Christians. And we found him and brought him in the work and set him up and he hived off. In other words, now I made a mistake in that regard. I didn't spend enough time with him. Desperate, overworked, lazy, taking shortcuts, didn't spend enough time with him, and the whole work wandered off into all kinds of funny areas for a while, and it's coming good and coming around. I was very thrilled that late last year he invited me to come and preach to the church there again, and he really has made great progress back with us, in fellowship with us, and he's a good man, he's a great man, but he was going through the traumas of being a boat person himself and trying to find himself in the new country. He really needed my support and help at a time when I tried to palm it off on other people. It's hard work. You've got to spend the time equipping and recruiting the person, the long term. But the investment you put in there, of course, means the work is done. Now, we've started on a whole range of things. We started off with university students and through that tried to reach postgraduates and staff and failed totally. But we were able to see university students converted, and that led to a whole graduate church. Of you would call them yuppies, they hate it, so I won't call them that. Child-free adults. That is how we reach the high-rise dwellers. Because the reason they're living in high-rise is because they're child-free adults. That's why they're living where they're living. But we didn't reach them by knocking on the doors of the high-rise. We reached them by starting off where they came to the city in the first place in order to study.
And then as they moved on from study into work, they moved into the flats. And as they moved from the flats, they moved into marriage. And so instead of being flatmates, they were marriage partners. And then the families came along. And so through the uni church, we saw the child-free adult church. Through that, we have now seen the family church taking place. Through the family church, we've seen the ladies' Bible study, the young mums really of the world, and we're starting to see the men's ministry, the business men's ministry taking place, and we've established the Sunday school and the youth work. Whereas the village, you went in and you started a Sunday school, and through the Sunday school you found the parents, and we've gone the completely other way around. We've never actually tried to reach anyone through our Sunday school. In fact, we don't want the locals to come to our Sunday school, and we certainly don't want the locals to come to our youth work. It's terribly hard for people to grasp hold of this. But our youth work, our Sunday school, is there in order that we can reach the parents. That's what it's there for. If we don't have a good Sunday school youth program, the families won't stay with us. We're interested in the families. That's where we're trying to reach. It's not an evangelistic outreach. It's a maintenance work, the Sunday school and youth work. If anything, it's an evangelistic outreach to families, but not to the children. Now, my friends, I'll come to you in a few moments. Tremendous cost in that, because there's lots of kids hanging around the streets of Paddington who need the gospel of Jesus Christ just as much as the kids of our congregation. But we don't have the resources to reach them. And if we spend our resources on reaching the kids in the streets of Paddington and bringing them into our congregation, the families will leave. Then we won't have the resources even to pay the youth worker out in the street. You've got to make your choices in life, friends. And you've got to start off from the point of resources and how I can use my resources to reach the markets around me. Third main heading. They go much quicker now. Growing over time. Yesterday I warned you about telescoping time, hearing about 10 years in two words. And forgetting that 10 years is a long, long, long time. Church growth is about growth. Trees being buildings going up, you know, inch by inch, centimetre by centimetre, brick by brick, bit by bit building. At the moment we're ministering to about 1,500 people every week. For the first year we were ministering to around 80 people each week. It takes a long time to get from 80 to 1,500. A lot of blood, sweat and tears in that kind of period of time. And very few of the original 80 are still with us. Handful only. Where we do with growing is you've got to start foundation work. Hole digging work. Getting the seed in the first place. And there are several starting points. There's the structural entry point. If you're going to do a particular social structure, then there's a structural entry point. For us, it was the gates of the university. I stood on the street in Anzac Parade outside the gates with my leaflet in my hand and not a soul to help me. That was life where it started. In a sense, it starts with one man standing at the gates with the leaflets. But everybody had to walk through those gates. Then I found there were 15 gates. So I was told about the enrolment office where everybody walks through a door. So the next year I stood outside the door with a few friends. I was glad. Oh, was I glad for those friends. There is the point. Now, there are other starting points, aren't there? New workers in the factory, if you're doing industrial chaplaincies. New workers in the hospitals, if you're doing hospital chaplaincies or something like that. If you're going to do a village thing, well, then the people I'd go for immediately, always, are the new arrivals in the housing. I'd ingratiate myself with all the real estate agents around the place and with all the removalists. And every time I saw a removalist van, I'd be around there like a shot. The newcomer coming into the society, into the structure, who has got no connections in that structure at all yet, is the person who is most open to me as part of the structural organisation. I wouldn't invest my time in theory, I don't do this. I wouldn't invest my time knocking on the doors of every street. I'd be spending my time knocking on the doors of the newcomers. They're the ones. We find second and third year students are not nearly as a productive field of inquiry as first year students. And ponderance, obviously, isn't it? The other point of entry is the personal entry. To find the person in the group. Now, some people talk about gatekeepers. you know, that there are certain key people in societies that if you, in clubs, in organisations, if you get them because of their popularity, their leadership, they'll get everybody else. I'm not quite meaning gatekeepers, although if you can get them, well and good. I mean, people who are in the group that, in a sense, I'm going to reach. So, having embarrassed him already, I met Archie, you see. He's a Christian who is in a particular group. I will spend time with him. The same time I met another Greek called Nikki Farduli. She's a lovely girl. And I can't remember for how long now. I can romanticise it, make it better than it is, and Archie's got a good memory, so I can't do it here. But week by week, for years and years and years, six months in other words, or one session, which is only 14 weeks, I met with just Archie and Nikki doing Bible study with them. I didn't care what Bible study we were. I can't even remember what we went through in Galatians, I suppose, and then we went through Two Ways to Live. I do remember we went through that, and I just poured my time into them. There were hundreds of kids in Bible study in those days, but I picked those two people because they were the gateway into a whole new community. Nikki's still with us. A lovely Christian girl, is Nikki. In fact, she's taken up jobs that have led her to work on the university in the administration, to still be close by us as well. And we've been able to build that work. A couple of years ago, I met up with Robert. Robert was a Croatian, and we saw Robert converted, going through 7 basic Bible studies. But because he was Croatian, for no other reason than because he was Croatian, I kept meeting with him. I was only doing one-to-one work with one person on the campus. And the 1,500 people I ministered to each week, there was one man I was actually ministering to individually. It was Robert. Not because he was tall, handsome, not because he had a black belt in karate, which he does, but because he was Croatian. And I'd met so few Croatian Christians, and as I got talking to him, I found out there's a whole Croatian community out there, totally untouched by the gospel. Now, what is the resource by which we're going to reach that community? It's the Croatian Christian, isn't it? And he knows almost nothing. I don't care spending my life with him, that he could reach them. Well, we found a little group. We got up to about 4 or 5 people. It all fell apart. I thought the Greeks were violent. The Croatians terrify me. That Eustachy, I tell you, it's scary stuff. And it's all fallen apart. But we've worked out that we're going down the wrong track. We didn't have to be so specific. We can't be Yugoslavian because there's no such thing for the Croatian. They're Serbs. And Serbs are the devil. So, can't be that. But the Croatians don't relate to the Serbs. They do relate to the Slavonic peoples. Not the Slovenes, but the Slavic peoples generally. And so we've opened up our group now to a Slavic ministry, which takes in a whole group of different nationalities in the Eastern European bloc, which they feel happy. The Croatian feels happier with the Ukrainian than he feels with the Australian. And so we've picked up a Ukrainian girl, a lovely Christian girl, and there's one of our staff members, a Slovene, and he's a lovely, fine Christian man who'll come here to college in a couple of years' time, a brilliant evangelist. And so now we've got a little group of 3 or 4 or 5 who are meeting each week for Bible study that is the foundation of a whole new ministry. At one stage, well, it's 3 people, Philip. I mean, big church growth. I tell you, 3 who are in that part of the world, that is massive church growth. That is enormous church growth. That is 7, 8 years ago, it was 2 Greeks. And you could say at that time, just 2, Philip. But a whole ministry is building out of it as a result. Where's this going to be in 10 years' time? I don't know, but trees take a long time to grow. Bit by bit. 10 years' time, I'll be talking to you, and I'll tell you about this Slavonic work, which has got, you know, 40, 50 members. And people will say, oh, 40 members, must be easy to get together 40 people. They forget that it takes years and years, one by one. But it comes from the resource outwards. Then you've got to help them establish the structures. I'll go into that in a moment. But I've found that as I've got hold of a resource and built that, that it's nearly always branched out to other markets that I didn't expect. So when we started up the overseas work with the focus group, mainly amongst Chinese students, we stumbled across an Indonesian who started up an Indonesian work. A few years ago, I stumbled across a Ugandan, lovely Christian man from Uganda. Next thing I knew, there were Bible studies in my home for all Africa. I'd never seen. It was a marvellous time I had with the African students, because this one Ugandan man is a great evangelist. He saw an African in the street. He'd crossed the road and talked to him. Next thing I know, he's in my lounge room. Couldn't maintain that because there's not enough of an ongoing African community in Sydney for it to be maintained. But if there had been, we would have. the GBF, the Greek Bible Fellowship, I was greatly amused the other year when we baptised the Lebanese Muslim there, who we've now married to the Italian. And you see, when we started the uni work and then we moved into the flat-dwelling graduates, well, the graduates knew the secretaries and knew the nurses. And so if you come to St. Matthias now, it is not a university church. Less than 50% would be graduates of a university at St. Matthias Church now. People don't understand this. Everyone knows all about it. They don't understand. The university church meets on Friday night. We don't have students at St. Matthias anymore. I haven't had them there for 5 years. All the students meet on Friday night at the university church. St. Matthias is child-free adults. That's what it is. And we've now started recruiting a whole new batch of child-free adults. People who have grown up and had their children leave them. Ian Powell's parents come to our church on Sunday with their child-free adults. They come on Sunday nights and are part of our congregation. And so it branches out into all kinds of new markets all the time. That is, I haven't sat back and thought, now how am I going to reach Croatia? Never even crossed my mind. I didn't even know there was a Croatia. I meet up with a person. Now this is all about cross-cultural evangelism there. What do you need to be cross-cultural? Open and flexible in yourself. Secure enough in yourself to be open and flexible. To be concerned for the salvation of all mankind. And therefore, looking for people who are different to you. But then, a thorough believer in assimilation. Now, let me just do a quick red rag for you. I am absolutely committed to both multiculturalism and assimilation because I think both of them are completely wrong. Multiculturalism, as an ideal, that we're going to create a society where everybody's going to preserve their own culture, is whistling in the wind. It's the most stupid idea I've ever heard of. Absolutely stupid. There's going to be one law for the Croatians, another for the Serbs. We'll have a civil war taking place in our streets. In fact, if you know anything about it, we do. Multiculturalism is a stupid idea. It really is, as an idea. It is a reality that Australia is no longer one culture. It is a whole mixture of cultures. Assimilation is an arrogant, racist idea. Everybody has to become like us. Appalling idea. But assimilation is a reality. Everybody who lives in Australia winds up speaking English. They do not stay in their own culture. And we do not let them stay in their own culture. I mean, some will die still speaking the mother tongue, but very, very few. Their grandchildren will certainly speak English. Assimilation is the direction we're heading. But it's not the assimilation of everybody becoming Anglo-Saxon. It's the assimilation of Anglo-Saxons becoming something other than what we used to be. It's got to be two-way assimilation. And that is taking place. Gone are the Yorkshire puds and the potatoes, and on is the sweet and sour pork and the rice. Assimilation is taking place both ways. Now, we may never reach the stage where there is one Australia. We may never want to reach that stage. We may constantly be bringing in new cultures that will freshen it up. But we're not going to remain white, and we're not going to become black. It's going to be something in the middle there, somewhere. We'll all be the chocolate kind of variety down the future. And milk chocolate, but chocolate. That's where it's all going. Now, in crossing cultures, I'm hopeless in languages. I can't stand some of the ethnic foods. Things I've had to eat for the sake of the gospel, you wouldn't believe. But what I look for is the person who comes halfway with me and I go halfway with them. See, sorry, Archie. One of Archie's great blessings is that he grew up in Lismore. There's hardly any Greeks in Lismore, so there was no Greek Orthodox Church. He had to make bigger jumps than the average Greek in Marrickville. He had to come further across the Australian cultural barrier. And so I was converted through the Methodist Church, would you believe it, up in Lismore. Is he really converted? And so when I meet up with this Greek as opposed to the other Greeks, he is one who can walk in two worlds. I can relate to his Greekness because it's not so way out and enthusiastic and unreliable as the other Greeks I've tried with my first two Greek churches fizzled, right? Because I couldn't get them to be responsible. I got them enthusiastic, but
totally irresponsible. You can't build a church in irresponsibility. But he was one who was sufficiently Anglophiled to be responsible as a person, but yet was still sufficiently Greek to be Greek amongst them. He becomes a crucial bridge that I myself couldn't be, but he gave me the resource by which I can reach that community. Now, I take it they're the people in particular. That's why my Croatian mate, I'll spend hours with him. You wouldn't believe the things I've done with my Croatian mate, because he's a man who can walk in my world enough for me to be able to relate to. But he speaks and thinks in Croatian at home. Funny man, when he goes to university, he actually thinks in English. And when he goes home, he thinks in Croatian. And very interesting. You can't even explain it. But he walks inside in town and he actually counts. He does his maths in Croatian at home, and he does his maths in English at university. You see? He is the cross-cultural evangelist. I'm not. He is here. And because he is already assimilated to some extent, I can put myself out that extent and reach him. But to try and get me to learn Croatian would be a complete dud and waste of time. Okay. Now, what I said, that was the third thing under growing over time. Part of it then is establishing structures. This is the fourth point. Let me return to that. Establishing structures. Having got my resources, having reached that person, having seen them established in some form of ministry, I have to establish the structures whereby they can do the ministry. And here is where the mainline church have a complete mental block. We think church growth equals my church growth, my church's growth. We think that the way in which it's going to happen is, now that we see the Croatians converted, they're going to come and join our church. You think that, forget it. Just stick to doing a parish work, will you? See, there's a lovely man I met in England who was a parish man, who maintained a parish church, but all his ministry was amongst high school students. That's where he did his whole work, in high school students. And through his ministry in high school students, hundreds of men and women on the mission field and in the ministry today. And the parish, as far as I could see, never woke up to the fact that he really didn't put his effort into the parish work at all. I mean, he ran the services for them, he preached for them, he faithfully, diligently buried and married them. But his heart, his labour, his effort, his work, his time were in high school evangelism. And through that, hundreds of people converted. But the high school kids he saw evangelised hardly ever wound up in his parish church. We keep thinking not like that, you see. We keep on wanting to build the thing we have. See, we've set up things like the Italian work. We saw Luciano converted and then Rocky converted. Somewhere, isn't it around here? I'm downstairs in video land. It never stayed in the eastern suburbs because Italians are not there. We tried to establish a structure for Luciano by working in the Department of Evangelism, but it really didn't work as an itinerant ministry. And so found there were two centres of Italian work out at Liverpool and in at Leichhardt, and over a period of time found ways of bringing the ministry of the Scarcellas out at Liverpool and the Ricci's in at Haberfield there to establish the structures for it. Likewise, the Vietnamese work, the structures I could establish couldn't contain. But the Greek work, well, the New South Wales structure is not a bad one. We were able to actually help sponsor them and establish them. In the long run, my hope and expectation is that they will grow up as an independent church to us. In always, hopefully, in brotherly fellowship and goodwill and love and kindness and all the rest, but in the end, we will keep funding them and encouraging them and helping them in any way we can until they reach the stage where they can be making their own way forward. I don't go to the Greek Bible Fellowship very often these days. You see, in the first stage, every week with the two members. Nowadays, I think I'm making about 4 visits this year. And I play very little part in the decision-making about what happens. Now, if they ever need me for anything, I'm always willing to do it for them if I can. But It's away from me now, but I take it to church growth. Sometimes you build one thing on another, like the uni church, which led to the evening congregation, which led to the family congregation, which leads to the business, and it's all still within the program that we're running.
Now, you need structures that are going to accept different people. What kind of structures will do that? Well, those that are mature in Christ will. Those who really believe that the gospel's all that matter, they'll put up with anybody coming in the door. But friends, there are not many who are mature like that. You must be. If you're not, you're not fit for the ministry of the gospel. But don't be surprised that your congregations aren't. That's why you're there in the ministry of the gospel to them, to encourage them on into maturity. They will want to assimilate to us. They want people to come in and be like us, rather than people coming in and us changing to be like them. And so I think the transition stage is multiculturalism. It's a transition stage because in the parousia we'll all be one together. Sometimes before the parousia we'll see that oneness together as well. But in this lifetime, it's a multicultural transition stage. 4 or 5 generations down the track, you see, the Greek Bible Fellowship may not have any reason for existence outside of normal Australian churches, because our Australian churches may become so mixed up ethnically that the Greeks are indistinguishable for us, and we'll all merge back in together. And there might be so few Greek-speaking Greeks left in Australia that there's no reason for a Greek church. But at the moment, we need that. The transition stage is very important. What would ever make the mainline churches bend, become open? Well, desperation and death. When they actually reach rock bottom so they can't pay their bills, they will bend. But I tell you what, it really has to be rock bottom. And usually, some good-willed, kind-hearted idiot bails them out. Could shoot some relief agencies. Some groups, they bail out the impossible. Hang on for another 10 years, another 15 years, and denominations keep doing it. Finally get people to the stage where they're willing to change. And you stop them with money. Or they'll change if they're mature and of real faith. I haven't been to those churches often. Or they'll change, I notice, when they get an ethnic minister. When the bloke out the front is not Anglo-Saxon, they become much more open to accepting in non-Anglo-Saxons. That's an interesting one that I've seen. What stops them changing, of course, is when they're strong. They're so strong they don't even recognise how oppressive they are to the outsiders. Or when they are weak and therefore insecure, terrified of the ethnic group that's moved in around them, that's killing them off. Mind you, the ethnic group is always a minority statistically, but they still feel it's there. And that's why our church is going downhill. It's hardly ever the reason. Or they won't change because they're racist, which is basically an Anglo-Saxon tradition to be profoundly racist. Or they won't change because they're legalistic Pharisees, which is a particularly Anglican tradition. Now, because my time is short, that is not this morning, because my time is short, I've only got 20 years left in ministry. Because my life is short, God willing, I'll get 20 years or so. I haven't got time to wait till everybody's going to be changing and bending. Just haven't got time. And you think you have because you've got 40 years. Don't be deceived. You have it. It goes very fast. So just gather in people in separate organisations. Leave the door open so that the Muslim Lebanese can come into the Greek church. Leave it open for anyone, but aim at a particular group whom you can occasionally bring all the groups together. You can work with each other. We do big, you know, lecture theatre evangelism from time to time with the Greeks and the Chinese and the students and the everybody in. Promote the weak. I think Acts 7 does that with the Greek names of the deacons that are chosen. But time is too short to try and get this great ideal of everybody together everywhere. By the time you've ever achieved that, either the Lord will return or you'll be taken. Hopefully you'll be taken. And in the meetings that I run, in any one of them, there are a couple of central goals. Christ and the gospel and his word is always got to be there. But there's the double P. I always aim to make it pleasurable and profitable. Can't always succeed, friends. But that's the aim, pleasurable and profitable.
If it's pleasurable, they want to come because they don't have a principle who says you must come. You've got to make it that people want to come. But if it's only pleasurable, they'll get sick to death of it. If it's profitable, they'll keep coming. But if it's not pleasurable, they'll keep coming under law. Pleasurable and profitable is how we've got to run our meetings. I think they're the end points. You see, gospel, Christ, the word of God, that's one. Pleasure, profit, they're two and three. I don't have, I think, any other requirements as to what we've got to do. Hymns, if they're pleasurable and profitable. No hymns, if it's more pleasurable and profitable without them. I mean, you make the decisions from those kinds of things. Enormous flexibility. Last point, paying the costs. Yesterday I talked about the cost of personal growth. I'm not talking about those costs now. I'm talking about ministry costs, which do impinge upon you personally, but ministry costs. See, I guess I get a little worried about this week for you. I shouldn't, but I do. Because it's so easy to get superficially excited about all the good things that you can hear that are happening and you can do, and yes, I could do this, and you can see yourself out there, and I shouldn't try and dampen your enthusiasm in the slightest. But what worries me about church growth is that people don't perceive how much it costs. And they'll superficially run out and try and do things, and they'll fail at this point. Resource development requires paying enormous costs. For every day you spend recruiting and training people is a day that you're not spending evangelizing. And every structure you develop will be developed at the cost of other structures that you haven't developed or maintained or cared for. What you can do, you see, is respond to the agenda of the squeaky hinge, or you can act out of the agenda of a gospel strategy. And while you're sitting here, it's absolutely obvious which you'll do, isn't it? But in 10 years' time, more than 50% of you will be doing the wrong one, judging by my contemporaries. Because squeaky doors are very irritating. They have a tremendous power to call you to run from one emergency to the next, to the next, to the next. And of course, there's no way you'll get a gospel strategy going doing that. I haven't taken any funerals, weddings, scripture classes, visited the sick, gone to hospital, done any counselling or made any home calls for the last 5 years, which accounts for nearly all my curacy training, which is another reason why I think curacy training is such a stupid waste of time. I haven't done any of those things. That's not where I started, but where I did start was refusing to take any funerals other than direct members of our congregation, refusing to visit the sick, even the members of our congregation, refusing to have anything to do with any parish visiting or seek to reach any of the local community, and refusal to take any scripture classes. Now, if you think refusing to do those things is easy, then you really are wet behind the ears. To refuse to do those brings you into incredible criticism within the local community, to say nothing of the criticism within the denomination. To refuse to do those things is to deny the faith of the ordained ministry. But it is to save the faith of the gospel. Funerals are a dead loss. In our part of the world, the only people who are dying are people who are isolated from any family connection. So when you run the funeral, the only people you're ministering to are people that you'll never minister to again. There's absolutely no ministry potential for funerals in our part of the world. Other parts of the world, the village, that would be different. In our part of the world, nothing comes out of funerals. Not even a good pay. The funeral directors don't want me. The deceased relatives don't want me. I've got no opportunity really for gospel ministry there, and it takes a day a week to do it. And if I'm any good at it, I can do four or five every week. If I do that, what chance have I got to evangelize anybody, to build up anybody, to equip anybody? I got none. So I rang up the funeral directors and said, I will not take any funerals unless specifically members of our congregation. Basically, they take the heat. They ring up other people and get other people to do it for them. There are other clergymen around who love doing it. Got nothing else to do with their time. I'm very glad for them. To tell the congregation that I wouldn't visit them even if they're sick. Devastating. Shock, horror. Some immediately became sick. I'm a teacher of the Bible. I'm a preacher of the gospel. Most people, when they're sick, want someone to hold their hand. That's what I want when I'm sick. I don't want someone to come along and expound the third chapter of Ecclesiastes to me when I'm sick. I'm not in a fit position to hear what the Bible's got to say by and large there. And anyway, the comfort of Christian fellowship and prayer and encouragement, all the members of the congregation can do equally well with me on that regard. They didn't need me to visit the sick. It's just a tradition that clergymen visit the sick. I haven't got the time to do that and do the other things. If I'm going to take the resources seriously and reach the markets, I can't do those things. I said I wouldn't reach the parish. Didn't have time to do that. In fact, I told the parish, and there was an agreement, I said to them, I will have no parish work for 5 years. I will continue as the university chaplain, which I still do. I will do no parish work for 5 years. Do you still want me? You might not understand why, half left in protest. They accepted me. I have still not done any parish work in terms of the local area. Still haven't done it. That's 12 years later. But we have more people from the local parish, the pound inside the parish boundaries, which in Paddington are tiny. We now have more people from within the parish coming to our church than at any other time this century. Yet for the previous 78 years, men poured their hearts and souls into reaching the local parish. Because they approached it as a village, which it isn't. It hasn't been for a century. Went door knocking, ran the Sunday school, did the youth group, did all those traditional things, and never could lift it above 25 people or 30 people, according to the record books of services. But by trying to reach students and yuppies and things like that, all kinds of people who happen to live in Paddington have been reached through those networks and now come to our church. Let me tell you of our toilets. Our toilets were a lean-to created last century against a building which unfortunately the National Trust has now classified, and therefore the toilets are classified. The toilets, I think, were grotty last century. I wasn't around, but I suspect they would be. Today, they are not much better. Every parish council meeting for the last 12 years has discussed the toilets. We have a monthly toilet conversation. I have been pressured for 12 years to raise the money and the wherewithal to rebuild the toilets. They still stand as a testimony to my refusal to actually take it seriously. Oh, I take it seriously. The discussion's serious enough. We've got plans. We've got some of the most magnificently architecturally designed plans of any toilets in this world, seeing we've got a church full of architects. We still haven't got any toilets, though. Now, we will build them in the next year or so. Possibly. We've had to get the National Trust to agree that we're allowed to do it, all kinds of things. They will come. But you see, if we'd rebuilt them back in 1978, it would have taken somewhere in the vicinity of 25% of our year's budget. If we build them in 1989, it'll take less than 1%. We couldn't afford it back then. We just had to learn to go across to the park, where there are better toilets, not troops. I could see. I was looking at Michael Rater when I realised what was being thought there. Missionaries. Just have to put up with it, friends. Now, do you think it's been at no cost? No, look, friends. The number of people who have whinged and complained to me, you wouldn't want to believe it. The number of hours lost in parish council discussing it. The number of plans and proposals. I've never stood in the way. I've just never put my energies into doing it. And so it's just lingered on year after year after year. It's about ready now because we can afford it now. Now, it's important to have good toilets at your church because that's part of making the plant attractive. So that people, when they come to church, say, oh, this is a nice place. But it's a secondary. But you've got to make hard choices in ministry. Very, very hard choices. Very unpopular choices. Because everybody wants everything all the time. take note of Paul Keating. He's not the world's greatest treasurer, but he's not bad at saying no, is he? And he's under tremendous pressure to say yes, isn't he? Everyone wants him to say yes to everything. You can't run the economy and say yes to everybody. You can't muster resources and utilize them effectively and say yes to everybody.